Grants Pass by Merlin, Oregon, between some miners and Bureau of Land Management. This had actually been a dispute that had been going on for a few years. But this specific case, BLM told some miners they had erected a building. They'd done some work on their claim, made structures, and the BLM said, "We think you're in violation. Here's some paperwork. You have to return it." And instead of returning the paperwork, they called their buddies in the Patriot Movement, local oath keepers, three percenters, people from around the country, to come and establish armed camps to hold the BLM off. The miners claimed, at the end of the day, they really were claiming the BLM had no jurisdiction and that the miners essentially owned these mining claims as if they were private property, that they could treat them as if they were private property. So this alerted some people in Oregon with the Rural Organizing Project. This really wonderful group in Oregon has 50 local groups outside of Portland in the rural and small town part of the states. They contacted the think tank I work with, PRA, and they said, "Hey, what's going on?" And we said, "Hey, you've got a lot of really crazy Patriot Movement activism there. That movement's supposed to be in decline, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, but it seems like it's in full swing in Oregon." So for the last year, I've been looking very closely at the Patriot Movement in Oregon. I live in New York, but I spent quite a bit of time going back and forth to Oregon, traveling around the state, talking to people, and investigating the movement.
So, Spencer, the reason this Patriot Movement is growing in power, that just tells me that there's something that's not working very well for local residents in rural areas. What is it that the Patriot Movement organizers are able to capitalize on in recruiting people to their movement?
Well, that's absolutely right. There is real discontent in the rural areas. I think everybody knows this. The rural Oregon was always based on mining, but particularly logging wealth. And the rural areas were quite wealthy in the post-war period until the 70s and 80s when it started to flatline. Some of these economies, like in Harney County, which is where the Malheur Refuge is, the economy has flatlined since the 70s. Some of this does have to do with restrictions on logging on public lands, but a lot of it does not, too. Some of it has to do with changes in the international timber industry, advances in automation that make hiring large number of workers no longer necessary. So these rural areas, small-town areas, they're pretty sparsely populated in Oregon, you know, outside of Eugene and Portland. People are still there. Population that moved there to engage in these extractive industries are still there, but there's not much economy there, and nothing has really replaced it. And at the same time, discontent is almost always in areas with high percentages of federal land ownership. Harney County is something like 73% federal land. Oregon's about 53% overall. The Patriot Movement is popular in counties with high levels of federal land ownership. For example, in Columbia County, there's some well-established Patriot Movement activists there, but they've never been able to get much popularity, and we think that's because there's a very low level of federal land ownership in that county. In my experience, they're not looking towards other ways to develop their county economies. They're completely fixated that only natural resource economy, that's the only thing that they're thinking about. And since that's off the table, the only thing they can think of is to unlock why it's off the table, which is to allow a revival of ranching, mining, and logging on the federal lands where they're now restricted from doing that instead of developing alternatives.
We've also seen a number of reports around the United States where the suicide rate is the group that kills itself at the highest rates in the United States is white males. I've seen a number of stories in the past couple of months about how white women are drinking ourselves to death at a higher rate. And when I look at what's happening in Oregon in the rural areas and this political organizing among conservative people with conservative values, I can see why the timber wars, the resolution of the timber wars back in the late 80s, early 90s, where some of these natural resources, the extractive industries, became locked up into federal ownership. I can imagine that actually really supercharges the political anger that the organizers are using.
A lot of white working class people. The world is changing. Economies are changing. The U.S. is changing. The demographic of the U.S. is changing. You don't see it so much in Oregon, but it's really just part of the U.S. that's majority white left in the center and northern part of the U.S. Most of the rest of the U.S., I think, at this juncture. I'm not quite sure that in the South is even changing very rapidly. It's not a country that their parents or grandparents lived in, and they're not. People don't have an expectation, even if they're doing better, even if white people are doing better than other racial groups in the U.S., as a group, better, even working-class white people than Latinos or Blacks or Native Americans or other groups, the expectation of the level that they they would be able to achieve in their life, especially economically, is declining. And so it's just a relative, it's a relative thing, and I think that's what's really pushing the suicide rate. They had certain expectations of what their life would be like, and that's not going to happen economically. And the country they grew up in is changing. I mean, we're becoming a different country. The right wing in the rural areas, the powers that be, have always blamed environmentalists on putting restrictions on logging on public land, and that is part. But I don't even think that's. I'm not an economist, so I couldn't say. But it's certainly not the only part, and it might even be just a small part of the decline of the logging industry. Some of it has to do with technological changes. I was in Cottage Grove, and my friend was like, oh, look, there's a mill. And I'm like, there's a mill in Cottage Grove? And she's like, yeah, but it only employs 4 people. Even if you brought logging back, it would never, even if we logged every last tree in Oregon, it would never return all these jobs here. Those jobs don't exist. And in some cases, it's because of foreign ownership and other changing structures. It's an easy thing to blame federal environmental laws for all these problems. They're not the cause of all the environmental problems in Oregon. And in many cases, locking, quote, locking these lands up brings in a lot of tourism dollars. It brings in federal employees who get paid from the federal till, so they're getting benefits and salaries that are all not coming from the local economy. Feds are paying for the roads. So there's a lot of federal subsidies that actually come in with these things, too, but the Patriot Movement just ignores that. They pretend a lot of wealth will be produced in rural areas if we could just log the federal forests without restrictions, but in their calculations they completely ignore what's going to happen when all the federal employees go away and all the money they bring in and all the tourism dollars that come in because of them.
Yeah, I think we saw that with some of the rhetoric that came from the takeover of the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. I wonder, as we watch what's happening politically around the United States, the whole world is watching what's going on in this country. And so on the left, people are trying to sort of break out of what they consider to be everyday party politics by perhaps supporting Bernie Sanders instead of Hillary Clinton. And on the right, people seem to be doing the same thing, except they're reaching for Donald Trump over Ted Cruz or whomever else might be there. What does that mean? What is your sense of what this disenfranchisement of white conservative people in the Oregon rural areas and the rise of the Patriot Movement, what is that saying about our electoral politics?
The Republican Party seems like it's about to crack in half. The old alliance between the Christian right and the business conservatives that went on for decades is being, it seems like it's been hit by the Tea Party, by Sarah Palin and the Tea Party. And it's going in a tailspin, and now at least half or more of it is this sort of conspiracy, driven by conspiracy theories. It's driven by this demonization of immigrants and demonization of Muslims. All this kind of paranoid rhetoric is now mainstream. Things that even 2 or 3 years ago you couldn't say in public, or no reputable person would say in public, Donald Trump is saying. And so the Patriot Movement is happening in that. I think they're all more part of the same context. Clearly, Trump's popularity is making the claims, the political rhetoric of the Patriot Movement sound a lot more mainstream than it would have even sounded 2 years ago.
Why is this a big deal? How is the wider country impacted by the growth of this Patriot Movement? I mean, and you had just said resorting to armed takeovers, but I'd love to hear what your big take is on that.
It's dangerous because they're armed and they totally believe that they have the right. They're using the language of the traditional American political and legal system, even though their views, I think, are outside of that. And they think they have the right to enforce those views with paramilitary action, and they're not afraid to stick a gun in people's face to do that. They want to settle up whatever differences I have with Americans and our political system. I do appreciate that we try to settle our differences without resorting to armed action. We don't go and assassinate each other's political leaders like happens in Lebanon or Iraq or something. We don't disagree with somebody. We keep it fairly civil on that level. And these people think that they can, even if their views are similar to a lot of other Republicans, that they can settle their political disagreements with guns. And these armed takeovers, because the one in Malheur, there was one before in Oregon and Josephine County. There was one at a mine in Montana. And then there was the big, armed standoff with Clive and Bundy a couple of years ago down south, I believe in Nevada. I always forget it was right on the border. But there's a lot of other armed actions, too. There are Oath Keepers are holding one of the big Patriot Movement groups are hold armed marches. There's this wave that have these open carry marches, which, I mean, they're legal. Usually we don't have armed politics in the U.S., and this is pushing armed politics. People are holding armed marches outside of mosques because they are religious bigots and they hate Muslims and they demonize Muslims in the same way that, German Nazis demonized Jews in the 30s. So there's a lot of armed action going on in the United States today. Some of these groups, their rhetoric is incendiary, and they're all armed to the teeth. People like the Three Percenters, and they're saying if the new gun restrictions are passed, they're gonna resist with armed resistance. We had in Oregon, y'all had a state senator and two state representatives appear on stage with the founder of the Three Percenters, Mike Vanderbilt, who called on stage for there to be an armed civil war against Governor Brown and the current state government, while other state reps and state senators were there, you know, who had just shared the stage with him. It's worrisome that there's tens of thousands of people in this movement who seem like they're getting ready for armed conflict, and who most or many of whom possess, you know, firearms already.
Should we be embracing the people that live in the rural areas, or should we be afraid? What is your take on it? You've been doing a lot of thinking about this and these dynamics. What should we do to fix this situation?
I wish I had an easy answer for you. I can tell you we need to recognize, I agree that our state officials and our federal officials have abandoned people in rural areas. Like, that's just the truth, and they don't care, and this is causing a lot of pain, and we, you know, even those of us urban lefties or whatever, here in New York City, need to recognize the reality of the howls of pain that are existing in rural areas, and that the crisis is real, and that they're not, it's not made up that there's a problem, and people are looking for solutions to it. I think people need to, even while we recognize that the solutions that people who join the Patriot Movement are the wrong solutions, and these are bad answers, and even not answers at all, that their solutions won't turn out to be real solutions either. People need to educate themselves a little bit about this movement, find out about what its actual politics are, try to offer alternatives where people can. You know, I think the Rural Organizing Project is definitely looking for concrete alternatives we can give to some of these communities.
Spencer Sunshine, Political Research Associates. Tell us one more time where we can read more of your work.
It's available on PRA's blog, which is politicalresearch.org, or you can see all my articles on my own website. It's SpencerSunshine.com.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Special Election Night Broadcast. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting an evening with Brooklyn-based soul and blues artist Charles Bradley, Thursday, May 19th at the Crystal Ballroom. Tickets and information for Charles Bradley on May 19th at the Crystal are available at cascadetickets.com.
Annie, are you okay? Annie, are you okay? That's really cool.
That is cool. Hey, welcome back, everyone. This is live coverage of the Oregon primary. We have with us Ani Haynes. And
maybe that song was about Ani. Ani, you okay?
Oh, I think it was.
That's why I kind of was saying that. Ani, are you okay?
That's hilarious.
Okay. We'll ponder that.
While we're thinking about that, there are some updates coming out of Kentucky. And let's see, 3,688 out of 396 precincts have reported in already. That's 99% of the precincts. Hillary Clinton has just over 212,000 of the votes with 47%. Bernie Sanders has 46% with 210,000 of the votes. 24,000 were uncommitted. Martin O'Malley had 1% with just over 5,000 votes. And Rocky De La Fuente had... it says here 0%, which is not very nice, but he had 1,500 votes for the record. And for all of you that are not aware already, the GOP caucus happened back in March, early March. Trump won it with 36%, Ted Cruz 32%. So that is the latest coming out of Kentucky. We are, of course, are in Oregon, and there should be some updates that are headed down the pipes in the next half an hour, so we will definitely keep everyone updated. But now, before we bring you more coverage of the election, we are going to have someone else on the show joining us.
Well, just real quick, we just want to say that it's still only 7:13, so you still have
time to drop off those ballots into the drop box. You have until 8 o'clock tonight, and that's actually you can actually be in line at 8 o'clock, and they will still accept it. So get in that line by 8 o'clock if you would like to turn in your ballot and have your vote count. And Coyne, I think you have a couple of tweets for us.
Yeah, I was going to mention a couple of tweets coming out about U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. Oregon's active voter turnout rate was 70.9%, 23% higher than the national average. That was a tweet. But he is being chastised by others for his stance on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. People for Bernie, they tweeted, "It's close in Kentucky, family, either way. This will be a win for at Bernie Sanders as he prepares to sweep in the Oregon primary." In Klamath Falls, this has happened. Hashtag Oregon primary ballots stolen and thrown in trash. Ballots taken from ballot box thrown in dumpster in Klamath County. I don't know exactly how true that is, but it is a tweet that went out. And then those are just some tweets that we were given and thought I'd share that with you. So, yeah. We'll have to figure out about that Klamath County.
We'll follow up on that. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. Watch your ballot there in Klamath. Do we have our next guest on the phone? Margo, we're going to be joined here by Margo Black. Margo, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, Margo. Happy Election Day to you.
Happy Election Day to you.
Have you already turned in your ballot, or are you one of those people rushing in the last 45 minutes to your Dropbox?
I turned it in about 30 minutes ago.
Oh, look at that. See, she's not procrastinating too much. She got in there before 7 o'clock. Good for you.
And there are people standing on the curbside waiting to take them. So, you know, it's an easy
process.
I have
to say that most of the people I know who are some of the most civically minded people I know waited until today.
What do you think that is, Margo?
Well, I heard some people talk about it being kind of there being some nostalgic reason to vote on Election Day. And I feel that. I know some people were really waiting until the last minute to make a couple different choices. I know that was true for a lot of folks with the mayor's race, for example. You know, sometimes last minute info can come out. And so wanted to make sure they had all the facts in. A lot of us are just procrastinators and really busy and happy to have the luxury of doing it, you know, whenever and it turns out to be Election Day.
Well, Margo, we'd love to speak with you because you are an activist surrounding the issue of houselessness here in Portland. So could you speak about what issues you're following today with the elections?
Well, just to clarify, my advocacy is around tenants' rights. That certainly involves houselessness, but I don't want to overspeak from the people who are really on the ground working on houselessness, because I'm more focusing on keeping people housed in their rental homes. And I'm sorry, what was your question?
What issues are you particularly focused on today for the elections?
For the local election, I've been really watching and following the mayor's race and the city council race, because I have been really working on folks, you know, taking leadership on rent control, on just cause eviction, on fair housing protections, and doing as much as they can on the local level around that, but also, you know, providing some advocacy and leadership when it comes to the state session, the legislative session next year, and trying to get something done locally so that the state can follow our lead, or at least putting more pressure on the state and showing that there's a mandate for that.
So do you think that, well, I guess in looking at all of our candidates coming up here, do you think that tenants' rights are going to make a step forward after today's? Do you think the results will yield results?
I absolutely think so, regardless of who wins, and regardless of whether or not we have a runoff or we have a clear winner. We had every single mayoral candidate talking about rent control, talking about just cause, talking about fair housing, talking about houselessness. Every single mayoral candidate spent the night at Hazelnut Grove and has put some fairly creative ideas forward on dealing with houselessness. And so I do think that no matter who wins, there is a mandate to do something. That being said, I think that you know, one of the most exciting things that has happened in this election cycle, in part due to Bernie Sanders really, you know, telling people, you know, it's not me, it's us, and we have to organize, is that, you know, people are activated and ready to push for the changes that they've gotten some of their candidates to talk about. And so I guess I think that the pathway has absolutely been carved for tenant protections, regardless of who is elected. But it would be an absolute loss for us to think that the work has been done after the person gets into office or just is elected to office. I think that we need to massively organize on the ground around, you know, what we want, go big, ask for things that maybe 6 months ago seemed impossible and now seem like, how could we not be talking about rent control? How could we not be talking about just cause evictions? But it's going to take folks on the ground from, you know, both the tenants' rights movement and the houseless movement and the environmental movement and the, you know, everybody who is organizing around these issues that are really, they're really passionate about to join together in a united front to make the change that they want to see.
So you just brought up Bernie Sanders. I'm curious to hear your perspective on how the national race is affecting politics here in Portland.
Well, I think that all of the candidates are aware of how awakened, certainly Portland, but all of Oregon has been around Bernie Sanders. I think that it has sent a very clear message that the people want an authentic politician, a politician or leader, you know, who is not going to just respond to big corporate interests, who is willing to take risks with platforms that actually meet people's needs, that are going to recognize the urgency of the issues that the folks on the ground are facing and respond to those in, you know, bold ways that translate into real solutions for real people in real time, rather than, you know, some little tweak in some code somewhere that ultimately just puts, you know, more money into the status quo's pocket. So I do think that that has certainly translated into some more interesting campaign promises. It has certainly changed a lot of conversations on the campaign trail. I know that, you know, the candidates are certainly recognizing that a lot of people are going to turn out and vote for Bernie. If they're going to turn out and vote for Bernie, they're not also going to check the box for the candidate who isn't willing to, you know, take a risk with some proposals that will really help folks. And I think we've seen that. But again, it's not going to happen without us continuing to put pressure on them and hold them accountable.
Absolutely, Margot. Margot, thank you very, very much for joining us this evening. And giving us your perspective, and thanks for the work that you're doing with Portland Tenants Unit.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is our live election coverage of, the election from the national to the very local. And I'm Ani, and I'm here with
Jenna Huddy.
And Kanan.
And Sequoina.
And next up, we have Simon Tam. Simon, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So, Simon, this is a very, very interesting election, and I think I've been having this conversation all day about how this is possibly the most circus of the bread and circus-like events many of us have seen. And just initially, wondering your take as a mover and a shaker in the communities, how are you feeling about the election from the national to the local?
Well, I think I'm actually quite excited, especially with the recent motor voter bill. Seeing such a high level of voter registration is definitely exciting, and I hope that we see more people being civically engaged than ever. The one kind of thing that I feel a little bit like anxious about is how divisive the politics have been, especially on a national level. Even amongst people who normally would agree with each other, there seems to be a lot of vitriol right now, and that's a little bit disturbing. But I'm hoping that people can come together, find that we oftentimes share more values than we think, and can build a cohesive community from there, you know, from the local level all the way on up to national.
So, Simon, what have you been following the work with Apano and the Ally Group?
Yeah, a bit.
I know that you do work with Apano, and you've just done so much work to bring visibility to the API community, especially here in Portland. And I was just kind of wondering what your take has been watching all these issues coming up and you know, seeing these voices being given to these young people who are trying to bring more visibility to the community. Just sort of getting your take on the visibility of APIs here in Portland right now.
I think thanks to the great work of groups like Apano and, you know, CACA and the other entities around town, that our voices are finally starting to become more visible. Oftentimes when we talk about social justice or issues of race in this country, we tend to think of it as a black and white narrative. But it's great to see some underrepresented communities finally being invited to the table. And we see that in a couple different ways. I mean, recently the Apano's Ally Youth Program won a major victory by ensuring that the Portland Public School System would now teach ethnic studies across its curriculum, which is amazing, which is absolutely unbelievable. But we're also seeing that the City of Portland and several of its committees and bureaus are starting to allow participation from those communities as well, whereas before last year, we weren't even thought of. So it's great to see that there's a little bit more awareness now, and beyond just the, you know, hey, it's the month of May, let's do a proclamation that's Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. Now we're starting to see that it's more than just, you know, celebrating food or festivals. It's about getting actual community members involved.
Well, so Simon, we're actually running pretty short on time, but we have to make sure to ask, have you turned in your ballot yet?
Oh, yeah. I mailed it in the day I got it. So.
Oh, look at that.
I was excited. I already knew the candidates I wanted to support, the issues I wanted to support. I mean, there's a lot of critical things, everything from the Portland mayor, which I think there's some really important conversations being had there, to even things like the Portland gas tax and trying to think, okay, what is a way that we can develop a sustainable, safe community. So there's some just a lot of really important issues that are near and dear to me.
Well, Simon Tan showing us what you can do in your election fortnight. You can vote on day one, or you can vote weeks and weeks later. Well, thank you very much, Simon Tan. Simon Tan from the band The Slants. Thank you very much for joining us here on this election night.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, next we are going to our very own KBOO reporter, Kristen Yout. Kristen, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Kristen, where are you right now? Tell us, our listeners, where you're at.
So I'm at Old Chicago at the 205 Plaza up here on Stark. Might I add that is east of 82nd Street. And I'm here with Jesse Sponberg. He is having a party, and he's got lots of supporters here. Everybody, even the staff here, is wearing Sponberg for Mayor t-shirts. Very exciting. And he's pretty excited to talk to you. So are you ready for Jesse?
Sure, bring on Jesse.
Hang on.
Hey, this is Jesse.
Hi, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse, thank you for joining us. How is your election day going?
So far, so good. It's pretty mellow. Not a lot of butterflies, you know. All the hard work's really been done. I'm not into pandering and shaking a sign at the last minute to try to get a couple votes. So we're just hanging out and I think there's a baseball game on.
How do you think things have gone for you, Jesse? This is Ani, by the way. What's like one highlight in your campaign that you're the most proud of?
The one highlight in the campaign? When I got everybody to sleep in the mud at Hazelnut Grove with all the rats running around them. I was pretty proud of that.
That's excellent. And Jesse, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And you are at again where?
We're at the Old Chicago at Mall 205.
So supporters can find you there.
Yeah, East Portland. We're just right off 205 exit and Stark. There's TVs everywhere. It's a real nice environment. It's a little corporate, but
hey, thanks very much for joining us.
But before you go, Jesse, how do you think you're faring out amongst the voters?
Man, you know, it's really hard to tell. You know, when I entered this race, I thought it was just going to be, you know, pretty cut and dry with a couple people, but so many incredible candidates have risen since we started, and I have so much respect for all of those guys that, man, I can't even really call it, you know? I mean, is social media presence more powerful than the amount of old people that are still alive? Or, you know, two clicks equate votes? Or is knocking on doors the answer? Or does Sean Davis have it because there's 43,000 vets in Portland?
Well, thank you very much. Really... Thank you very much, Jesse. Thank you for taking time while you're in your party. Good luck to you. And thank you for taking our call.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Right. Take good care, Jesse.
All right, guys.
So up next, we've got Cameron Winton on the line. Is that correct?
Hi.
Hi, Cameron. Thank you
happy
for taking.
Election day.
Yes, happy election day to you. And we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. This is Sequoyah, and I'm also with Jenna and oh my gosh,
we call him Kanan. We call him Kanan.
Yes.
Oh, wow. It's been a long night.
It has been a long night.
Yeah.
So where are you currently? What is your ETA?
I'm currently on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I've been to 4 election night parties so far. There's so many races right now. And so just making sure that, you know, respecting people who put their name in. I was a candidate 4 years ago.
You were.
I was.
And you fought a very hard election too.
Hey, I'm proud to be a loser, you know. I just ran into somebody today who told me that they wrote me in for some position. And it's just interesting that people still remember me 4 years from now. So it's an honor. And I just know there's probably people, candidates, we're trying not to throw up right now.
So
about them who put their names on the line. A lot of them probably have had nasty things said about them. Campaigning's hard. So I'm really worried about tomorrow and how can people have healing and how can we as a community remember that democracy is not just an election cycle. It really is people being involved and making a difference.
Yeah, we just had mentioned a minute ago, we were talking with Simon Tam, and he had mentioned the vitriol, the level of discord and mudslinging, not just amongst the candidates, but amongst supporters of candidates.
Yeah.
And, how can we heal these rifts as we obviously all need to be working in communities together moving forward? So what do you have to say to that, like the answer to the level of vitriol right now?
I totally agree. I've been doing some nonprofit work for the past, half year. And so I have not been engaged as much in the election cycle. And even I feel like I've been caught in these crosshairs of vitriol. And it's so painful and it's so dehumanizing. And for, someone like me who's so passionate about politics, I'm kind of like happy that we can finally move past Election Day, because I think really it is us remembering why we're here. We're here to make policies, make a difference. And that's really my message. It's like, yes, these elections are going to suck. Yes, we always have candidates that, aren't going to be, pushing the envelope enough. But that's why we need, the people. And I think I've seen so many great grassroots movements that have come up recently. Black Lives Matter, 15 Now. And we're pushing real progress. The fact that, we can even get the state legislature to pass a minimum wage hike, thinking that we haven't done that in almost 10 years. So there's so much that we need to do, but I think looking at great candidates that we've had, like Nick Caleb, who helped found Right to the City, Joanne Hardesty, who's now, director of NAACP, there's a lot of amazing leaders who have lost elections. Even myself, I'm now a nonprofit executive director. It doesn't end at losing. Doesn't end up winning either. It really is the work that you do in the long term.
What are you most excited about in this particular campaign? Knowing that democracy is not a one, pull the lever one exercise every 4 years, but what are you most excited about from this particular campaign?
That is a great question. What am I most excited about? Really, I think I'm excited to see the results. There's probably only a couple of races where I really am wondering it's going to happen. Portland Mayor, Multnomah County Commission, District 1. I think that nobody really has a complete idea of what we're going to see in terms of turnout. Are we going to have a runoff? Is someone going to win it in the primary? These things are possible, and I think it's really going to change the conversation we have over the next 6 months. And I think, once we find that out, I'm really excited to see what the dialogue is, because we'll have some people who will straight up, win, be elected officials. How do we hold them accountable? How do we set those relationships? And those who aren't elected yet, I think it's just a really great time for us to build a more progressive platform and really get people on record. There's been a lot of candidate forums that have happened for the primary, but I think by showing that we have a general election happening, it's really just showing that the people want better answers. And if we get that, I think we'll be a big, you know, benefit for everybody in the city.
And I think we have to end it right about there. Thank you, Cameron Witten, for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Thanks,
have a great
Cameron.
Night.
Here on KBOO's election fortnight coverage. And coming up next.
Next, we're going to be running a story that we actually weren't able to run in the news earlier today, but is really important to all of our lives here in the United States. And it's always the issue of where the churches are at, which definitely affects our politics as well. So the pressures and tensions are mounting at the United Methodist Church's World General Conference being held here in Portland at the Oregon Convention Center. More protests and petitions to welcome LGBT people into the church peppered the convention this year. Yesterday and today during that. Speakers, including the presiding bishop, gave heartfelt speeches about the future of the church and whether it can stay unified. KBOO reporter Theo Burke was on scene again today and captured interviews, press conferences, and singing.
This hymn was the sound of dozens of LGBT pastors, ministers, and clergy interrupting the afternoon floor session again today at the United Methodist Church's General Conference at the Oregon Convention Center. Another day of protest and other developments has put pressure on this conference to welcome LGBT people into the whole of the United Methodist Church. Yesterday, a letter signed by 1,500 supporters of the 111 ministers and clergy who came out as gay one day before the conference was announced at a press conference of the Reconciling Ministries Network, a gay advocacy subgroup of the United Methodist Church. We now hear from Reverend Ginger Gaines Sorelli, who spearheaded the letter of 1,500 supporters of LGBT from a press conference yesterday.
Jesus broke the ecclesiastical purity and Sabbath laws in order to heal and liberate hurting people. Amen. And the church must be willing to take risks, cross boundaries that have been traditionally seen as forbidden, and welcome those formerly and erroneously believed to be impure and untouchable. Amen. Our LGBTQI colleagues have blessed the church, are blessing the church, and will bless the church.
The pressure tactics are increasing tensions at the conference, and tomorrow, 100 petitions having to do with LGBT inclusion are going to be considered, and there's even serious talk of a possible split of the church into two denominations, conservative and more progressive. Today, the presiding bishop of the World Council of Bishops in the Church, Bishop Bruce O, gave a heart-rending speech where he said he had a broken heart about what's going on in his church, and he admitted that the Council of Bishops is, quote, not unified, unquote. He also said that the Council of Bishops is, quote, not fearful of radical ideas, both conservative and liberal. This was seen as a reference to both LGBT inclusion petitions and petitions to break the church into more than one denomination. Tomorrow will be a big day at the conference, I'm told, as a lot of the petitions and legislations on these sensitive issues will be presented on the floor of the conference. We finish tonight with part of my interview with Reverend Donna Pritchard of First United Methodist Church here in downtown Portland, which is a reconciling congregation, meaning that it is already accepting of LGBT people despite the position of the whole church. So as a pastor from a reconciling congregation, are you optimistic about sticking together and still being able to be an authentic voice, especially for the American church?
Absolutely. Ministry always happens within a context. And that is certainly the case for us here in Portland. And whatever happens with the General Conference of the United Methodist Church, we're still going to be there. I'm still going to be in the pulpit next Sunday. I'm still going to be helping my people to make a positive contribution to the Portland area. We're still going to be hosting 8 families every night who are in our homeless shelter, the Goose Hollow Family Shelter. We're still going to be providing space for countless community groups and even for a couple of Portland public school classes that are now meeting in our facility. So it's not going to change who we are, and it's not going to dissuade us from our mission to transform the world that we live in.
Well, Pastor and Reverend Donna Pritchard of First United Methodist Church here in Southwest Portland, thank you very much for being with KABU.
Thank you.
I'm Theo Burke for the KABU Evening News.
And you are listening to the KABU 2016 election night coverage live broadcast. We've spoke with Joseph Santos Lyons, Mary Pavetto, Sean Fleek, Bruce Placenta, and a host of others tonight about their take on this election year. And so now we're going to go ahead and get a live update from, I believe, Jenna.
Well, the latest update we've been hearing is that the Hillary Clinton headquarters are saying that it looks like Bernie is going to be taking Oregon. But we will be waiting to hear more official.
Shocker.
Shocker, shocker. Well, and you know, if you heard that and you said, hey, that's not who I voted for, guess what? You still have 20 more minutes. You can still turn in your ballot, even whether or not Hillary Clinton's office is declaring anything. You still have 20 more minutes where you can turn in those ballots into an official drop box. Just go ahead and walk it on over. Remember that postmarks do not count. Do not put it into the mailbox. You'll be sad when your vote is not counted. So to get it counted, make sure you put it in a drop box. And live in studio, we are now joined by fellow KABU News reporter Emery. And Emery, you're here to tell us about some really, really interesting stuff going around the state.
Good evening. Yes. As well as Bernie and Hillary, we also have ballot measures going on across the state.
Oh, yeah, those things.
Yeah, those confusing things.
Ballot measures, yes. Hi. Well, let's go ahead and name the ballot measures. There's the gas tax.
Okay, yes. So there's the gas tax. There is something going on with the historical society or history funding,
funding
in Portland. Yep. There are a few measures across the state having to do with marijuana. And then there's Cascade Locks and Nestle. Cascade Locks trying to keep Nestle from opening up a spring.
In that bottling plant.
A bottling plant, yeah. Exactly. Okay, so one of the more interesting ones is Damascus, because here we might have, for the first time in 40 years, a city in the state of Oregon disincorporating itself. So the voters are voting on whether to disincorporate the city.
So they're currently an incorporated area.
Damascus is just east of Portland, basically.
Yes.
And they're going to try to become an unincorporated area. So I'm just making sure I understand this correctly.
Where in the United States would that place them? Do we know? Do we know what happens to their status as a U.S.
town? Oh, okay. So they would dissolve, and then, so part of the reason they would do this is to be under the zoning laws of Clackamas County.
Ah.
And
so it takes away the municipality and gives it to a county level.
Yes. And I've read some things about why they want to do this. And it turns out that coming up in November, city leaders plan to put a vote to the people and say, hey, would you like to opt out of the legalized marijuana law in Oregon? And almost six out of 10 of the voters in Damascus before said, yes, we're against marijuana legalization. So if they vote yes today, there will be no city vote in November to opt out because there will be no more city. And there are no laws in place on a county level that ban marijuana.
Wow, Damascus, that they're doing all sorts of tricky things there.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Definitely a bit of trickery.
Interesting. So, yeah, looking at de-annexation of Damascus,
yes,
as a result or as a way of dealing with cannabis legislation.
Yes. Yes.
What other measures are dealing with cannabis on the Oregon ballot?
Okay. Well, there's 1258, measure 1258, which I believe is Grant County, which is out way far in dry Eastern Oregon, and there are dozens of counties and cities in Oregon that have enough voter support to opt out of various parts of marijuana legalization. So they don't want to have like marijuana stores on their streets or have people growing to sell commercially recreational marijuana. So Grant County, people are going to try to basically vote down the ban, take away the ban. And same in Klamath County. So these are two generally conservative Eastern Oregon counties. And if you read about this online, you see quotes from leaders of the counties who are generally not so much in support of the ban being taken down. So we'll see.
Does that mean that even possession will be illegal, even though it's legal within the state?
No, I do not believe so.
So it's mainly just about the distribution,
It's about certain types of growing, certain types of selling, but it's the counties and cities aren't allowed to like totally override the entire state law, but they're able to like do some certain things about recreational and commercial uses and businesses.
I see.
And it also there's a tax incentive and thing there. So lots of times cities and counties, they want to have businesses, they want the tax revenue. So this is one of the rare times when cities and counties are actually turning down tax revenue that would come from legal marijuana sales, basically based on ideology or politics or whatever.
Yeah, their thoughts on legalization and the drug war. And the thing, again, I think what you were trying to get to, Jenna, is that Oregon has actually had cannabis decriminalized since like 1972. So is this, you know, would these cities then be sort of looking at going back to the prior to the vote to have recreational use or medical use? To a decriminalized status, or are they looking for something even, you know, more extreme than a decriminalized status and a decriminalization of it? And I don't even know if those conversations have been had. Certainly, those conversations haven't come up in the ballot measures.
Right. These ballot measures have to do with like, okay, I want to grow marijuana in Grant County. I have a license to grow medical marijuana. And I can do that because that's legal statewide. But I want to grow recreational marijuana. And this is an attempt to remove a ban on that kind of thing. Or I want to open a marijuana dispensary, recreational marijuana dispensary in downtown, whatever, Malheur.
It'll be really interesting to see if these pass, what it'll mean for other counties, if they'll try to take on the same thing, or if they don't pass and people see, wow, it's just a failing thing. Like what? I'm surprised to see counties deciding to pass up tax
revenue.
Money.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right? It is an interesting thing.
Speaking of revenue, we could go to the Nestle bottling plant.
Let's do that.
Okay, so that is measure 1455 in Cascade Locks in Hood River County. Is that right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Nestle for many years has wanted to open a bottling plant there. They want to bottle like 11,000 gallons of water an hour for years on end. And voters are trying to put a restriction saying you cannot bottle more than 1,000 gallons of water a day from our natural spring that is part of our community wealth here. You're not coming in and bottling more than 1,000 gallons a day. They want to be bottling, you know, 238 million gallons of water a year. So it's an argument about all sorts of things. So Nestle is saying it'll bring jobs, it'll bring money, and et cetera. Yeah.
I was just going to tell you to get closer to your microphone.
Oh, okay.
my subtle hand signal.
Neophyte in the air room. So
what is the ballot measure specifically? Is the ballot measure trying to ban Nestle?
The ballot measure would be a ban. If you vote yes, you're voting yes for essentially a ban, because Nestle's not going to open a bottling plant there if they can't do the volume they want to do. And so if you like Google this issue, The Guardian actually ran an article on this today because it has national, perhaps international consequence, because if this measure passes, it might open up an avenue for similar sort of counteraction groups across the world to counteract bottling multinational companies coming in and doing this. So you've got the Western United States, it's drought stricken. Do you really want Nestle coming in here and privatizing this like beautiful natural spring water?
Such a big issue here in Oregon, where you have so many towns that have untapped resources, yet, you know, like out there on the gorge, they just happen to have the visibility. But how many little towns are there where they have that one spring that just hasn't been tapped yet? So this will be really interesting for the future of the Oregon economy.
Interesting model legislation, really, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not saying don't do it. It's a very interesting tactic.
So we are just about out of time for this segment. Is there any last thought of, wow, this came across my attention and I really want to bring it to yours?
Well, definitely the most confusing thing on the ballot for most people is the precinct committee persons. Have we brought this up? Did you see on the ballot?
Not yet.
You could vote for like 19 different people and it's really confusing. Well, so who these people are like, it was described by one writer as the roots in grassroots organization. So these people will go to a state convention and they will elect the delegates for the Republicans and the Democrats, individuals, delegates, who then go to the national convention and cast a vote for, in a Democrat case, Bernie or Hillary. So we tend to think of delegates as numbers, but delegates are actually people. And so when we're, it's, you know, what do we have? 10 minutes to get to the ballot box. But if you want to vote for precinct committee persons, that's what those people do.
It's not too late.
Kind of interesting.
It's not too late. You still have 11 minutes.
Well, if you've already voted and you didn't vote for your precinct people, then it's too late this time.
Then call your friend who hasn't voted yet and is being
irresponsible. And get them to 12th and Morrison in Southeast Portland in the next, call it 8 minutes. All right. We have Jenka Soderberg on the line. Emery, thank you so much for joining us on Election Fortnight.
Thank you.
Thank you. And hello, Jenka.
Yep. I am here at Pioneer Square. I've been watching a steady stream of last-minute voters coming in. Most of the ones I've talked to have been supporters of Bernie Sanders, but also some Hillary Clinton supporters, saying they just barely made it. And actually, the Multnomah County election officials are standing here just waiting to take these ballots away. And
is there much of a line right now?
What's your name?
Oh, this is
Josh. And Josh, who did you vote for and why?
I am ready for Hillary because I think she's a reasonable and experienced candidate who will be able to beat Donald Trump in the fall. That's all I've got.
All right. And just have a few more people around here. You want to talk to KBOO? Oh, we've got a KBOO, a supporter here with a KBOO t-shirt.
Yay!
Who you voted for?
Oh, you bet.
All right.
Hi, Bill Bernie Sanders, and pretty much straight Democratic ticket. And I didn't do as much research this year as I've done in the past. I'm getting old. And I did good old KBOO and Willamette Week. And I used to do Mercury and Oregonian and Scanner and then the Portland Tribune, but I missed their issues. So hopefully I voted for the right people. Well, thanks for being out here for KBOO.
Of course, yeah.
I was listening to election coverage before I came, and I cut it too close. Thought I missed the bus. I think I've been too late.
Yeah, but you made it. Just in the nick of time here in Pioneer Square, there's no line, you had asked, but there's people coming and they're putting their ballots in, and just Multnomah County officials helping people who aren't able to park right here, Pioneer Square, just put their ballots in.
What's the activity like there, Jenka? Is it pretty crowded?
I'm sick of this billionaire corporate crap. Kill your TV if you can't afford cable to see things like free speech TV. And put your money towards the nonprofits, KBOO, Jazz Station, Classical, and the new one, X-Ray. Because we got to have it. Otherwise, we're just stupid.
Well, thanks. Propagandized. And what's your name?
My name's John Rice. I call it all the time.
All right. Thank you, John. And so people putting their ballots in. And I've actually also talked to some independents who were surprised and disappointed that they were not able to vote for Bernie Sanders. So I think that's also a factor here in in this primary in Oregon that that independents are not able to vote for someone on the Democratic ticket, at least for president.
Is there a big line to turn in ballots right now?
No, there's not a line. There's just a steady stream of people, and they're able to, you know, put them in to the big box here in Pioneer Square.
Well, that's a big reminder to our listeners that if they want to go see Janka and take part in their patriotic duty, they have seven more minutes. Turn in that ballot right now into the official drop box and get their vote counted.
Janka.
Yes.
Hi, it's Aquina. So what are the signs out there saying? Like, you know, are there people standing out with signs? Like,
there aren't any protesters or picketers out here at Pioneer Square. There's been, you know, a few people come in, I guess, kind of walking by with friends and stuff, and then shouting support for Bernie is the only thing I've heard, but I haven't heard any other people actually. Just kind of a quiet scene of people dropping off ballots and rushing here to get them in time.
And in time is right. You have 5 minutes, 5 minutes left before the closing of the polls tonight on Election Fortnight. I love that. Was that you, Jenna? Was
it, Fortnight?
Who coined Election Fortnight?
That was my term.
I can confirm that, yeah. That was all you.
Brilliant. Okay, so here we are.
And like, well, actually, we should ask Janka. Janka, yeah. As you know, our election cycle or election day seems to actually be more like a two-week period, so we decided to call it Election Fortnight. What would you rename our elections here in Oregon?
The Madhouse.
Well, thank you, Janka, very much for joining us.
Oh, he's got a few more people in there, and they're rushing in, and a person is saying, what if I put mine in at 8:01? And the Multnomah County official said it would not be counted. They're going to close this at 8 o'clock on the dot.
They are strict.
And that is, in fact, in keeping with polling laws.
I kind of appreciate them following the law.
That is, you know, one of those things. All right. Any last words for us, Janka?
Well, I guess we'll see what happens with the results, but it looks like there's at least quite a few disappointed independents that were expecting to be able to vote for Bernie Sanders and then somehow surprised that he wasn't on their ballot.
Do you think that there's been adequate, you know, just information about how Oregon primaries work for people that might be new to the state? Some states have open primaries where you can vote for, you know, candidates regardless of your own party. And then some states like Oregon has a closed primary where you have to actually be registered in the party.
I think the open primary makes a lot more sense than the closed primary. We don't have it here for whatever odd reason.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Janka. We do have a quick phone caller. We're going to try to squeeze in a question from the community. Good morning. Good morning. Mm-hmm. Good evening, April.
Hi.
You're on the air.
One of those days, huh? Just a little bit ago, you were talking about the Democratic committee persons that, you know, you're supposed to vote for. Mm-hmm. And I really have wondered, how are we supposed to know who they are? I mean, I really don't want to vote for someone I don't know who they are, and they're not listed in the voter's pamphlet. So how do you get information about them?
To the best of my knowledge, if you are involved in the party, then these are the people who are actually involved in the meetings of the Democrats or the Republicans, you know. So to be involved in the party, I know that there are various groups that meet that are a part of the national party that meet locally to the county level, to the city level, to actually, I know there's an East Side Democrats meeting that happens. And this is how people within the party attempt to shape the platforms and do the work in between the elections.
So if you're not willing to go to another meeting, you have no way of knowing who those people are?
Basically. I don't have a clue, actually. I mean, I just don't. But this is my understanding.
I tried to look my representative up, and I Googled for about like 20 minutes, and I couldn't find anything about the representatives in my district. So I was kind of disappointed in that part of the ballot.
Well, there's definitely something that all the precinct leaders can better figure this out on how to pass that information on to the public. Well, we are running out of time here, so thank you very much for calling in. We appreciate you joining us here on election night.
And thanks for your concern about the process. And and thank you, Janka.
Thanks, Janka.
Stand out there in the last 2 minutes as Janka is standing there watching everyone running to that box. You still have 2 minutes. You can literally drop your ballot off for in the next 2 minutes. It has to be in by 8 p.m. And
a minute and 9 seconds.
Oh, my gosh.
If you're not there, it's
the countdown,
over.
Man.
It's, I'm just going to say.
Good pressure. Get out there. Run with your thing.
Oh, riding the bike up to the ballot box even now. Yeah.
You got 25 seconds.
You know. And I think that also means we're out of time, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's only just begun. We're ending our coverage here on air, but we are taking it to the internet. So join us on KBOO News. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, at KBOO News. So just remember, at 8 p.m., the polls close, and the first counts come out, and KBOO News will continue our live coverage. So you can definitely follow us at hashtag Oregon Primary, or always at hashtag Election Fortnight, and tell us what you think that the name of this election
final
should be.
Final thoughts.
And also at 8 p.m. is the Melting Pot with host Takimba. Listen to Takimba's World Music Mix and check out KBOO on social media. That's at KBOO News on Twitter and KBOO Community Radio on Facebook. Thanks for joining us on this special election night coverage.
Thank you.
90.7 FM, this is KBOO. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Jobar Rotisserie, specializing in brunch, lunch, dinner, cocktails, and wine, and live jazz and blues every Sunday, Wednesday, and Friday nights. Joe Bar now features a Saturday night late night DJ set with Tom D'Antoni and Dave Coben, focusing on jazz, R&B, funk, soul, and more. Menu, location, and more at joebarpdx.net.